We'll get back to the basketball on the court, which is where we spend most of our time. But as many of you know, there has been an incident off the court that has been impacting this ride for Alabama basketball for a long, long time. And whether it's our friend Clay Travis with some of the things he has said along the way on social media and some of his reporting, or whether most recently it's the New York Times, to which Alabama said were false reporting there. There has been a variety of different things reported and said along the way about Alabama basketball. And we're about to talk to Ryan Phillips in this hour, that's brought to you by our friends at Champy's Chicken on Highway 119 in Alabaster. And Ryan wrote a story in the Tuscaloosa Patch over the weekend, which was laid out in a timeline fashion of video that he has seen and documents that he has read, I will just say that USBWA Hall of Famer, basketball writer Hall of Famer, and longtime reporter here, Kevin Skarbinski, says this about Ryan's story and reporting over the weekend. Powerful reporting. Hope everyone who rushed to judgment against Brandon Miller, Nate Oates, Greg Byrne, Alabama basketball, and Darius Miles will read with an open mind. So we'll get to that right now, brought to you by our friends at Champy's Chicken on Highway 119 in Alabaster.
And Ryan joins us on the JohnstonRVCenter.com hotline. If you want to follow him on Twitter, and if you have any interest at all in this story or events in Tuscaloosa, I would suggest you do so at Journo Ryan, J-O-U-R-N-O, at Journo Ryan on Twitter. He is with us now from the Patch Tuscaloosa operation there. Ryan, thank you for the time. I hope you're doing well today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, guys.
Yeah, we really appreciate you coming on. I was blown away by the detail in this story. So you basically have viewed the video evidence that the prosecution has looked at, that the Tuscaloosa DA has looked at. Do you have any idea what percentage of video they have available to them that you have viewed for this story?
Well, to be clear, I'm not really going to go into my sources of how I got the video, or videos, I should say, but it's very extensive. I mean, really paints a picture from the second they're walking out of the club with both groups. There's extensive video evidence, kind of following both groups along after they have their initial altercation right off the strip, and then they separate in the 3 or 4 minutes between that initial interaction and then when the shooting happens. I think that's probably one of the most compelling things. I keep using the word compelling to talk about this story, but to have lived the last 2 months through this story, I was there when Darius and Michael Davis were both arrested, trotted out at the Violent Crimes Unit office. I went to the press conference where Nate Oates, addressed it for the first time. I sat through the 3.5 or almost 3 hour preliminary hearing for this case too. So you go through all that, you kind of get a narrative in your mind, right? Because there was already so much written about it. But there was something about it that didn't set well with me from the very beginning. And you do. I'm not a sports writer. I'm a more of a politics, crime type reporter. And you're always told to reserve judgment. Report what you know, not what you think. So in saying all that once I finally was able to be granted access to this trove of videos, I really came away with a different perspective. When you couple that with the full copy of the, I think it's something like 85 pages, like the court transcript, that you really do, everything starts to come into clearer focus with how the events, played out that night. And I think another thing that really gets lost in that is that court transcript. I think a lot of people don't understand that in a preliminary hearing like that, they don't allow cameras, video recorder, or any kind of recording equipment in the courtroom. So, I consider myself a professional journalist, but, me standing there with a notebook for 3 hours during a prelim, that's a lot to take in for anybody when all you have are your eyes, ears, and your notepad. So I think that brought a lot to the surface because I think it's easy to key in on things during that preliminary hearing. But where we're at now, I just think is miles ahead of where we were, on January 15th. Because there was so much initial reporting that came out that had kind of set that narrative. So I think everything's starting to come into clearer focus, and it will at trial too.
Well, it's just amazing that anything like this can come to a situation where there is gunfire and there's loss of life. And we all know there's three sides to every story. But back to the initial altercation, from what you've gathered, what exactly do you think really sparked it and took it to another level?
I'm not going to speculate. I'm just going to say, you know, kind of what has been, you know, entered into the official record and what we can see on video. But I do think both sides seem to agree that the entire thing started when this group, you know, that Michael Davis, Darius, Jaden Bradley are walking back to Jaden Bradley's car that's parked behind Houndstooth Sports Bar, that they walk by this Jeep at one point. And then words are exchanged. I think that Davis was having a good night. You know, I think he was having fun and said something to somebody in the Jeep. At that point, the window gets rolled down, and then words are exchanged between him and Cedric. This is where it already starts getting murky, because nothing that Cedric Johnson told investigators has been corroborated by anybody. You know, Asia Humphrey, who was Jamia Harris's first cousin, she was in the vehicle when all this went down. And granted, she had, I don't want to say an excuse, but she was sitting in, I think she was in the driver's seat at that point and was talking to somebody. She even said that she couldn't work the power windows. You know, I kind of had problems with that, you know, trying to talk to another acquaintance that was out on the street, not related to any of it. But she refused to corroborate anything that Cedric said. But then that we go from there, that Darius is seen on video, and this is all said in court too by his defense attorneys, that you can see him coming back and trying to corral his buddies up or trying to corral Davis up to get him out. And then this is that really crucial point where he claims that he saw a gun pass from the front seat to the back seat. And then, I mean, you can see him on video. He gets visibly concerned and starts, you know, getting them to hightail it out of there. You know, now it's worth pointing out that when the lead investigator was cross-examined on the stand, he was very quick to be like, you know, well, they had just gotten food. It could have just as easily been food that was handed from the front seat to the back seat. That, you know, I don't have anything to refute that, but on the video, like I said, there's definitely something during this exchange that's passed from the front seat to the back seat. So I think that's very important because, I mean, that was something that was really keyed in on during that preliminary hearing.
But on the flip side of that, it very easily could have been, it could have been a gun, it could have been food, it could have been anything. That's a great point by you. I want to ask you, Ryan, I want to make sure I read this right because reading comprehension is not very good. Cedric Johnson never has been under oath. He's never given anything where perjury is out there. Tell me about Cedric Johnson's role in this as far as your reporting goes, the facts out there, and do they know where he is as we sit here at 11:09 on this Monday?
Well, just kind of starting from the beginning with that in the immediate aftermath of the shooting, they're on Gray Street, and he pulls out, gets on University, and at this point, I think he is aware of the gravity of the situation, because it, by all accounts, it seems like Jamia was pretty much killed instantly by that gunshot to the left side of her face. So, and that's the mother of his child, a longtime girlfriend. So I'm sure there were a lot of emotions immediately turning and all that. So he pulls out, finds the University of Alabama police officer right there at the Walk of Champions near the stadium and gives a statement there. That's where, you know, I have a copy of that he says that after that initial altercation that Michael Davis runs up to the car and is like, I told you what I was going to do to you. I told you I was going to get you, something to that effect, which again, Asia Humphrey was asked this on the stand and did not corroborate that. That she was like, I didn't hear anything right before the shooting. So you rock on after that, that we start getting into the more like legal ends of all this. They haven't been able to serve him a subpoena, haven't been able to track him down. That's why he wasn't even called as a witness during the preliminary, because they couldn't find him to serve him. The other guy involved in all this, Shabonte Green, who's seen on video, they have that interaction kind of separately away from the scene right before the shooting. He was served a subpoena but was called as a witness during that preliminary and didn't show up. So again, if we're talking about, you know, that these people are victims in this case, which there still might be proof out there that they are, but I don't understand the rationale behind avoiding testifying in court. Again, if you were indeed the victim in this case.
Ryan Phillips is with us at Journo Ryan on Twitter. He's part of Tuscaloosa Patch at Journo Ryan. He's done an amazing job of watching a ton of video and compiling a timeline here of all the events that happened that tragic night in Tuscaloosa. And there hasn't been a ton of talk about this red Chevy Impala that you bring into your story here. Can you tell us about the significance of that Impala and kind of where it stands in the investigation as well?
Well, going back to the few minutes right after that, and I wrote this in the story because I do think this is so crucial because the story is like reading War and Peace. I get that, super long. But this entire progression of events, I mean, it'll take you longer to read this story than it did for this to happen. So, you know, we see on video that Cedric gets out of the Jeep at this point after the group with Darius Miles, Michael Davis, Jaden Bradley have moved on. And they are on video walking back, not in any big particular rush or anything, like back to Jaden Bradley's car. And so this time we see Cedric walk across University Boulevard, holding his right side, concealing his right hand. And it looks like he's wearing like track pants or something without, you know, a very good waistband. But you see him walk across the street, talk to a group of people, including Shabonte, and then walks back across the street. And at this point, he swaps with, I believe it was with Asia Humphrey, because she had been driving the Jeep like up to that point. That he swaps and he becomes the driver at this point. And then the Jeep pulls out and starts kind of moving around a little bit. And then at this point, we see, and this is roughly 2 to 3 minutes before the shooting happens, that you see this meeting between this Jeep and this red Impala, you know, in the parking lot of a nearby apartment complex, right? Well, Cedric is the only person that gets out of the Jeep. He's visibly agitated. At one point, it's like he points or something, like he's mad about something, or very animated about something. And this exchange happens. Nobody ever gets out from the vehicle. And he walks back, but then you see somebody get out of the back seat, go to the trunk, open it, retrieve something from it, and then get back in the Impala. But this is what's really an interesting little kind of sidebar in all this. The trunk doesn't all the way close, so it pops back open. And if, again, we're talking a story that is a matter of seconds, you know, how all this played out. It takes him a few more seconds as the Jeep is pulling out, you know, this parking lot, to then walk back to the back of the Jeep or the back of the Impala, close it after getting something out, and get back in the back seat. Now, you know, it's interesting that the investigator testified under cross-examination that he thought that there was only one occupant of the Impala at the time of all this. But then we clearly see on video, which was presented in court during the preliminary hearing, like this part of it was, that we know that that's not true, that there was at least one other person in the back seat. And if there's one person in the back seat, again, this is speculative, but it's kind of common sense that if one person's in the back seat, there's probably somebody else in the front passenger seat. And as of right now, nobody else has been named in this. I don't think they've been able to identify who those other two individuals were.
Okay, here's another thing that confused me, because I've been on that strip a million times, and you report at 1:38 a.m. a completely unrelated bare-knuckle fight breaks out near the CVS right there on the strip. Where were the cops at this point? Because I'm going to assume if the cops show up, that no matter how dumb this guy is, people aren't going to be circling around looking for trouble, looking to get into a gunfight. And I'm just a little surprised that the response time would take this long. Do you have any idea? Was there any police present in the area when this went down?
I'd hate to speculate on where they were positioned during all that, but I will say in terms of just the broader context that Grace Street is a very, you know, there's been a lot made about if it's one or two lanes. It's enough that, I mean, we can see Brandon Miller's car in the Jeep side by side. So it's big enough that it's a two-lane street, but it's very much a side street, kind of tucked away out of view from University. And that's right where the fight happened too. Like it was in not so much a secluded place, but it wasn't right on the strip in front of the club or in front of Quick Grill where you normally see like a big gathering of people. It was very much off down a side street. And as far as I can tell, and based on like the immediate response after it, you know, that I don't think there were any police in the immediate vicinity. I think the first contact that was made with police would have been Cedric Johnson pulling out and contacting that on-duty UAPD officer. And then round about that time, then the first 911 calls made from University Downs Apartments from Darius Miles to police saying his friend had been shot. So
I want to ask you two questions here. One, is it a fair assumption on my part to assume that the authorities have seen everything that you've seen? And then the second part is, what is one or two things that you have learned that you think has been most misreported, or things that jumped out in your reporting that is being perceived the wrong way or reported the wrong way by mostly people who cover sports for a living?
Well, what was the first question again?
The first question.
Two-parters always get me.
Yeah. And at my age, it's hard to remember what I asked, but here we go. The first one is to assume, that the authorities have seen everything that you have seen? And the second thing is, what are one or two things that you take away from your reporting that maybe has been the most misreported through this whole thing by mostly people who cover sports?
Yeah. Gotcha. No, I think with respect to what all the investigators have seen, I don't know. And I've really tried to say this as much as I can, that for all I know, they could come out with a stellar piece of evidence in all this that completely changes the narrative of the case. That's just the nature of how these things work, right? But I don't. I don't want to assume that I've seen everything that they've seen. But I think in what I have seen, or not I think, I know in what I've seen, that we can see step by step exactly how this played out. Other than, I think, and this is where I think so much of the prosecution's case is going to hinge on, is proving who shot first. That's, we can see everything up to that point, but you know, once we get into that, then it does start to get a little circumstantial, as opposed to, well, we know for a fact that one or the other shot first. Which again, I think if the police have any evidence on that that could definitively and conclusively prove it, I'd be using it now. Or, you know, really hinging my case on that. And as far as I know, I haven't seen anything like that. But, you know, I hope that answered the first part of the question. Second
yes.
part, in terms of the two things that I learned, because I'm not here to disparage, you know, any of my colleagues in this business, because, I mean, we all have a job to do, and I've gotten plenty of stuff wrong in my career. So, you know, it's not that I'm here to reserve judgment.
Well, but truthfully, most Alabama fans don't think you have any colleagues or peers. They you seem to be on a mountain by yourself.
That's fair. That, you know, I think the big one was the prevailing narrative that, you know, Brandon Miller was delivering the gun. I haven't seen anything that really throws up red flags. You know, I was talking to an attorney here just a few minutes ago that was like, yeah, we could probably have some big police text message dump or something like that. But if he delivered the gun, he would have been charged. Like if they knew that he was explicitly delivering that gun to be used to shoot somebody and they can prove it, then why haven't they? You know, I think that's pretty big. But I think that overall, in terms of like as a professional, what I've learned from this is the pitfalls of one source journalism, of rushing to conclusions. That is a great example in all this, that in the first like 2 or 3 weeks after Darius and Michael were both arrested, there's a story came out, I don't remember who it was from, but they were interviewing, I want to say the mother of Jamia Harris or something. And you know, the mother commented that Darius Miles shot her daughter because she had turned down his advances. You know, and then what was most jarring out of that is I remember getting on my phone, it was like scrolling on Facebook or something like that, and I see a YouTube link to some influencer who probably couldn't find Tuscaloosa if they had a GPS, you know, and it's got thousands and thousands and thousands of views and reactions, basically parroting this same story you know, without any kind of like basis in fact. It's just kind of first person testimony from somebody who, by all accounts, really hadn't seen any of the evidence or, you know. So I think that caution is what I've really learned from all this. And that was why I've really tried to incrementally do this story. To me, you know, the story I published this week, that's just the latest one. There will be more stories on this all the way through. And I think that's another thing that really gets lost in the way that just basic daily journalism is done, is in so many cases we write about the arrest, but we don't follow through with the case. And a great anecdote for that is, I'm sure you guys saw all the stuff with Trayshon Holden. He's the wide receiver from Alabama that transferred to Oregon, right?
Right.
And he gets arrested on like a felony gun charge or something. They kick him off the team. He's already getting publicly dragged, and then the DA's office drops the charges against him. But even his own, the program that had just taken him in, you know, rushed to conclusions on that. So I don't know. I think it's important people take a big, deep breath and a huge step back.
Ryan Phillips with us for a few more moments from Tuscaloosa Patch. This is a two-parter as well, but I'll separate them for, and you'll understand why. In watching the video, if you had to, with what degree of certainty could you tell me, based on the muzzle flares, who fired the first shot?
I really don't want to get into that, but I can walk you through it. I don't mind doing that.
Okay.
Because I do. I think that's the job of the investigators, the attorneys, all that. But I will walk you through
it. Hey, before you do, Ryan, let me ask you a question that has something to do with that. Because when I was reading your report, yeah, before you walk us through that,
This is where we become sports reporters again. We're trying to corner you into making assumptions.
I think this is kind of a fascinating part, because the way I read this is the black Jeep with Cedric Johnson was trolling the area. They were the ones really, really looking. Then the headlights snap off. It really seems at that point they're the instigator here. But my question is, if so, why would Michael Davis walk up to the driver's side window?
I think that they had already noticed to some degree, and this isn't speculation. This has been kind of widely talked about by both sides. I think it's just more like, to what degree were they thinking about it? But they were aware that the Jeep was circling, you know, that was in the area. So I'm not going to make any, you know, assumptions as to what made Michael Davis do that, but you know, the way it looks on camera is the Jeep pulls in behind Brandon Miller. It's almost like he spotted and realized what was going on. Again, I have nothing to substantiate that. That is what the defense thinks. But it's certainly not what investigators think.
Okay, then back to Brown's question about the
muzzle flares. I found that part very interesting, and I don't know that it's even clear on the video. I have not seen it. You have, obviously, as have investigators.
Right. Well, with this particular angle, and it will end up being shown in court, that you can see Davis run up from behind the Jeep. And then at this point, he's out of view. Like, he's on, you can see broadside on the passenger side for the most part, but you have a really clear, wide view of the windshield. And then you see, I mean, it's as soon as he runs up to the car. It's not like there's words exchanged or, you know, that as soon as he runs up, you see that first flash. And then, you know, there's corresponding timestamped audio down to the millisecond that first shot is heard and corresponds with that first pop or flash that you see. Then you see another one. And it's like right at this point that you see that second one, that it almost looks like Michael Davis, who you remember was hit twice. Cedric Johnson, according to investigators and the court transcript, he fired four shots and he hit Davis twice, once in the shoulder, once in the right hip. But at this point in the video, it's almost like he falls down. I don't know if the blast knocks him down or what, but you see him like almost getting up. And then it's like, at this point, he's got a little bit of distance between himself and the Jeep. And then you see that third muzzle flash from the same exact spot that the previous two had come from. And then it's at this point he has a little bit more distance, and it's pretty clear, you know, he fires the shot that hits the windshield that you know, by all accounts, seems to be the one that killed Jamia Harris. And then it's at this point he takes off running the opposite direction, and the cars both peel out. This is where the Jeep and Brandon Miller's Charger both kind of side swipe each other, you know, as they're both trying to pull out of Grace Street. But it was seeing that, and then knowing the evidence that we know that, like, where the shells were discarded, like, because Michael Davis was shooting a semi-automatic pistol, so it ejects the spent cartridges after every shot. They're able to kind of see a line, but the other guy was using a revolver, so all of them stayed in the chamber. But it is. It's when you look at that, especially when it's almost like you see him fall down after those first two muzzle flashes, and then knowing what we know that he got shot twice.
So,
yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to ask, is there any speculation at all on where Cedric Johnson is at this moment?
No, they've had a really difficult time tracking him down just to serve him. It definitely seems like he is trying to avoid coming to court on this, and he could have his own reasons, you know, more nuanced reasons than we can understand. But when it's something this high stakes, again, to double back, that this is the capital murder case for the mother of his child, and he is very much positioning himself and did position himself, you know, speaking to that first officer, you know, positioned himself as a victim. So I don't really understand why you wouldn't want to have your day in court on that. And it's not like, you know, the story that I wrote here in the last few days was the first time he was mentioned. That there have been mentions in several stories, you know, leading up to this about his role and why he hasn't been brought into court to testify about it.
At what point in the video you have observed, at what time is Brandon Miller's Dodge Charger first visible?
Oh, that's hard to say. I'd hate to speculate and get that wrong.
Okay.
But it's not, I mean, all of this, again, happened in the matter of just a few minutes.
Well,
and so much of it, I do think this kind of gets lost because one of y'all had mentioned it, about that fight. The group of people I'm seeing, I mean, until we have the whole exchange between Darius and Michael, you know, at the back of Brandon Miller's car when he got the gun, that the whole fight, like, they're totally focused on breaking that up because, again, it involves Darius's girlfriend. You know, the reason I mentioned her white boots in the story is because that makes her so visible. Like, you know, that if it's grainy, you got a lot of people, it's easy to spot those boots, right? So you see her again, you know, taking those boots off during this fight. So she's very much involved, invested in this. And then you see the guys break it up. And again, by all accounts, that was completely unrelated to the shooting that went down.
Yeah. The only reason, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, the only reason I ask is we know that the things that are not debated here, he received the text in question at 1:38.
Mm-hmm.
He is seen parking in the video at 1:43. That is a 5-minute window, which with the chaos that apparently was going on with that fight, that seems like a long time, but I mean, there appears to be a lot of chaos in that area. I was just curious as to where he was in those times is the reason I asked that.
And, you know, that kind of goes back to the whole Ty Spears story.
Right.
That it seems like he was very much the designated driver. I mean, I think both sides have pretty much...
That Miller was, not Spears, that. Obviously.
Yeah,
Miller
that,
was.
Yeah, that yeah. Miller was. But that I think that he had given several people rides throughout the course of the night, you know, just kind of being a good guy. Like, I don't, you know, and I think that's probably where the whole Ky Spears story got tripped up, just from what I can tell through extensive background reporting on it.
Right.
And it's interesting because there definitely was somebody else in the front seat with Brandon because the police testified to such, you know, during the prelim. But I thought it was interesting, again, if we're talking about the credibility of evidence, you know, in this capital murder case against them, the person who was in the front passenger seat with Brandon Miller when his car, let me back up, Brandon Miller, who's probably the most famous college basketball player in the country right now, you know, that we have somebody else in the car with him, and the investigator's like, I don't really remember his name.
Yeah,
I thought that was kind of odd.
It is very odd.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's another witness.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Another big witness.
Yeah, the guy is a witness to a massive event.
Right, and it's one of those they might not have seen anything, like whoever this person was, and I wrote this in the story too, the person might not have even been a public figure. You know, this could have just been somebody on the periphery that was just getting a ride home. And they're lucky, him and Brandon are both lucky they didn't get hurt or worse and all that.
And last question before we let you go, and we appreciate taking up more time than we probably promised you we'd take up. Of the video you saw, is and this may be a yes-no answer, and if it's just a no, I understand. Is any of the video you saw from Brandon Miller's dash cam?
No.
Okay.
I can say that conclusively. Yeah, as far as I know, no.
But that video, do you know if that video has been admitted as evidence, though?
I couldn't say. Couldn't say definitively on that.
Oh, so we don't know.
No, it was, I mean, it was seized through a search warrant, but I'm not going to have access to that.
Gotcha. So there was a search warrant for that video. We don't know if it's been used as evidence in the hearing so far.
Yeah.
Well, it seems the only thing that they've entered into evidence from that dash cam is the audio.
Okay.
That I think that's the only thing that the investigators really thought was pertinent, because it, the way that it's set up, if it's the kind of dash cam I'm thinking it is, which, again, this is purely speculative, but that's going to give you a forward-facing view.
Right.
All this happened directly behind him.
Right. And it's from that audio, am I correct? It's from that audio where they get the audio of basically the heat's in the hat and there's one in the head. Is that where they get that audio from?
Yeah. Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, according to the investigator. And that was after they had served the search warrant to get it. And that's what a lot of people should understand with this too. And that's why I'm like, really, I refuse to disparage investigators or the prosecution, because there's no telling what they have. They're not going to show me or anybody else, like, you know, in the general public. So, I think that's important to note to their credit, that they could have evidence in all this that, you know, blows it wide open. But the evidence that I've seen, which is far from basic, like, this is very, very extensive, you know, again, video evidence, testimony under oath in court, because that was how I really sat down to like write this story, was after really exhaustively walking through all of this video and then having the benefit of having that court transcript to basically lay over it and see where the consistencies and inconsistencies were. I felt like that painted the most objective picture, at least that I had seen. Because going back to kind of what we talked about at the very beginning of this, there's so much speculation right out the gate that I just really wanted to get this one right.
Yeah. All right. Tuscaloosa Patch covers local news and events in Tuscaloosa at Tuscaloosa Patch. If you would like to follow them on Twitter, Patch is a national online news service, digital news service. You can follow them at Tuscaloosa Patch. And if you want to follow Ryan at Journo Ryan, he is Ryan Phillips at Journo Ryan. You've been very patient with us. I know we asked you a lot of questions you couldn't answer, and we appreciate your honesty on that. And certainly appreciate the time, Ryan. Thank you very much for that.
Yeah, thank y'all so much for having me.
All right, take care. Ryan Phillips with us on the JohnstonRVCenter.com hotline.